This is the third day of this October 2017 seven-day session. And we'll take one more day with our teachings of Muso Kokushi, Japanese national teacher Muso, reading from the book Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. When we plant a tree, as long as the roots take, the branches and leaves will naturally grow and the flowers and fruits will develop. Therefore, when we plant the tree, we are concerned about the roots and not about the branches and leaves. As long as the roots have not taken a firm hold, we prune off the small branches so that the energy will go to the roots. He's talking here, of course, about practice. That does not mean, however, that we plant the tree for the sake of the roots alone. We take great care with the roots for the sake of the branches, leaves, flowers, and fruits. So, the root would be the matter of life and death, seeing into life and death, seeing into the essential. And the branches and leaves would be everything else, all the secondary practices, not just practices, but responsibilities and other worldly matters that are also important. So in terms of practice, this could be a number of things that support practice. Reading, to some degree. There's always a danger with reading that we not overdo it and make it a substitute for the practice itself. But it can fortify us and even inspire us, the right kind of reading at the right time when we need it, when we may be losing some steam in our practice. So reading, diet, and health generally to maintain the body, mind. Always with body, we can say it really means body-mind. This is another part of solid practice. Relationships of all kinds, you could say, are also the branches and the leaves and flowers. When he says we take great care with the roots, that is, with the practice, the practice of just what we're doing. We do this for the sake of the branches and so forth. We could say for the sake of our relationships. It nurtures, it elevates and enhances our relationships, practice. Well, surely everyone here knows this. And then there are other branches and leaves and flowers. There's our general culture, cultural things. Everything that contributes to a full life, not just for oneself, but for others, would be enhanced by practice. Even those who have realized the fundamental are still not completely enlightened in the Dharma as long as they do not know the techniques of a living adept, a practitioner. Such people may indeed have correct self-realization, but they cannot function as guides, teachers, if they lack methodological skills for helping others. This condition is sometimes referred to as attaining the intent, but not the expression. I don't care for these translations. Instead, we're going to use this condition, which you've realized the fundamental, but lack methodological skills. Let's say this condition is sometimes referred to as awakening or insight, attaining the essence, but not the skillful means, the method, the way of applying the wisdom that comes from awakening. This seems far less common, this awakening without having learned to apply it in one's daily life. This seems to be less common than the next one he talks about. He says, then again, even though people may have figured out some of the methods, practice methods, they themselves cannot be teachers if their own perceptions are not clear. That is, if they have not seen into their true nature. These are people who have reached the essence, who've reached the method, but not the essence. According to an ancient saying, those who have not yet attained enlightenment should investigate the mind rather than the method. They should look into the essence of mind rather than studying secondary practices. While those who have attained enlightenment should refine their skillful means rather than the essence. The essence is the inner meaning of Zen, which is the fundamental that is inherent in everyone. So this is the essence. We say it every time we chant the Prajnaparamita. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Seeing the non-dual nature of reality, what he calls the expression, is the varied methodology of the Zen schools. The essence is the root. The method is the branches. Students first need to discover the essence of Zen, not getting bogged down in methods or styles of practice. This is why it can be a mistake to spread oneself too thin in terms of trying different practices, different Zen centers or other Dharma centers. One is not really fully equipped to take advantage of these different offerings until one has seen into the great matter. I think in all things we have a choice between breadth and depth. If we want our exposure to the Dharma, or to just more broadly to spiritual practice, we want that to be broad and far-ranging, then we're not going to reach great depth in any of the many different things we do. And then he continues, after realizing the essence of Zen, people in ancient times used to spend decades polishing themselves thoroughly in order to free themselves from compulsions of conditioning and habit. This is called the work of maturation. The completion of maturation is called the attainment of unification, or we could say integration. This is not what beginners particularly want to hear. I know, having been a beginner myself once, I just wanted to hear that, okay, you work madly, you come to awakening, and then you're done. Because after all, awakening is the ultimate experience. Well, there are different degrees of awakening. And a first experience of awakening is almost always very slight. If it is awakening, then there is genuine seeing into the essence, the essential matter. But our conditioning, our habit forces have ingrained themselves in our character so strongly that it takes a while, a long while, to work through those things. Decades, Musso says, to spend decades polishing themselves thoroughly. This is what we're told the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, did after his awakening under the fifth patriarch. He was sent away and urged to just polish his understanding. And according to the myth, or the story, he spent some 13 years living with a band of hunters. And as the story has it, he would, even living with them in the forests, he would, when they cooked their meals, he would just avoid the meat, just take out the vegetables, and then after that period of time, he emerged from the forest, and he came upon this temple where the monks were arguing about the flag flapping in the wind, and this became a koan in the Mumonkan. Most of the masters whose writings we have read from make this point about how awakening is by no means, we're by no means done with awakening. We have to go on working to purify our personality and character, because these habitual tendencies are so stubborn in us. It's very humbling after awakening to see these things come back, the whatever they are, anger, irritability, moodiness, tendencies of greed, tendencies of delusion. One of the most clear expositions of this point is from Zen Master Kui Shan, a Chinese master, who put it this way: even though the original mind has been awakened by an intervening cause, there still remains the inertia of habit, formed since the beginning of time, which cannot be totally eliminated at a stroke. He must be taught to cut off completely the stream of his habitual ideas and views, caused by the still operative karmas. This process of purification is practice, ongoing practice, post-kensho practice. The still operative karmas. Karmic tendencies as a result of our having reacted to people and situations unskillfully over and over and over again, hundreds, thousands of times, in the smallest ways and in greater ways. Reactivity, this is what we're up against. Patterns of reactivity. And practice exposes these patterns for us. Sashin exposes these patterns. We can't deny them when we see them over and over and over again come up in practice. And now he talks about the side effects of strong practice, what the Japanese call makyo. There are various mental phenomena and mental postures that obstruct the potential for true understanding. Because of their harmful and destructive nature, they are called demons or devils. Makyo literally means bedeviling phenomena, things that cause obstructions. And they're not just mental, physical ones too. Many of us become well acquainted with physical makyo during Sashin. But he talks here about the mental. These demons include greed, hatred, conceit, opinionated views, addiction to meditation states, pride in knowledge, desire for personal liberation for one's own sake alone, sentimental compassion, anxious haste to attain enlightenment, idolizing teachers, rejecting the teaching because of finding fault with teacher's external behavior, indulging in passions, and fearing passion. Well, a lot of these wouldn't ordinarily consider makyo, these side effects. They're more just these problems that can arise through practice. Rejecting the teaching because of finding fault with teacher's external behavior. This, sadly enough, is something that happens too often, where teachers, because of teachers' misconduct, their students become disillusioned and quit practicing, which is kind of a tragedy. Anxious haste to attain enlightenment. That's because there still is in the mind this goal. I've got to get it. I've got to get it. Time is running out. I've got to get it. This does not lend itself to the kind of open questioning that really gives rise to awakening. addiction to meditation states. This is also not uncommon. We find our way into some state of some elevated state of great tranquility, and then that becomes enough for us. We want to just keep going back to that. But it's a conditioned state. All of these are conditioned states. So they're not the real thing. They when conditions change, they pass. And then he goes on, a simple method of quelling demons is to refrain from clinging to anything mentally. Here again, we could say, let's make it Makkyo, because we're in day 3 of Sesshin now, and this is where Makkyo become more common in Sesshin. Hallucinations, crying sometimes happens, and other visions, images that come to mind. And he tells this, relates this old story from ancient times, in which a strange person used to roam around the grounds of a hermitage of a certain meditation master. Sometimes this strange person would appear as a Buddhist saint, sometimes as a celestial king, sometimes radiating extraordinary light, sometimes uttering strange sayings. This continued for 10 years, and then it stopped. The meditation master told his disciples, "A celestial demon had been coming here to bother me, but no matter what appearance it created, I dealt with it by not looking or listening." And then this is the key thing. The demon's manifestations had an end, but my refraining from looking and listening have no end. And there it is. This week, you're confronted by images, memories, painful memories, wonderful memories. What do? You don't linger in them. He says don't listen or look. You don't deny them. You see them. You recognize them. You hopefully recognize them as Makkyo. And then turn your attention back to the one thing that matters, which is the practice you're working on. Now, I think pretty much everyone is clearer about what to do, how to proceed when confronted by Makkyo. But the test is whether you do it, whether you're willing to turn your attention away from these phenomena. If they're pleasant phenomena, and they can be fascinating, then it's harder to leave them. You lose your resolve, you lose your awareness and just get bogged down in them. And then what that does is hinder your forward progress. It's in practice where we always want to see through, see beyond, and never dwell in any state. Even awakening itself is not something to cling to dwell in. If you want to go further, deeper. And now he says attraction and aversion are two feelings that keep people within the bondage of ignorant, repetitive behavior. So attraction and aversion, sometimes it's called desire and aversion, or as Sung San puts it in our Affirming Faith in Mind that we chant every day, likes and dislikes. This, for people not seasoned in Zen practice, this can be hard to grasp the significance of this because we are embedded in a culture that encourages expressions of what we like and what we don't like. Never so clearly as the social media where we're liking or disliking. What could be more contrary, really, to pure Zen practice is registering what one likes and doesn't like unnecessarily. Naturally, we have likes and dislikes. There are foods and colors and clothes and any number of things. But the point is that the more we invest in our likes and dislikes, the more we are boxing ourselves in to suffering, or even if just mild suffering. Attraction and aversion are two feelings that keep people within the bondage of ignorant, repetitive behavior. Those who seek only what pleases them and try to avoid what displeases them are acting in this way because they do not realize the nature of the world. For those who know the nature of the world, lack of complete satisfaction or fulfillment in things of the world is in itself advice to cultivate detachment. If people do not crave to be pleased, they will not be displeased. What causes mental suffering is not the environment, but the mind itself. This is the arguably the premise of meditation, any kind of meditation, is that our experience of life, of the world, is determined as much by the mind as by our circumstances, the environment. This is an evolutionary leap when we realize this, that the most intelligent thing we can do in life is to practice daily meditation because it changes everything. And the more practice we do, the more sitting we do in a week or a day, the more we'll see the changes. If people do not crave to be pleased, they will not be displeased. Is another topic. He says, it is not necessary to get rid of worldly feelings in order to work on the fundamental. Well, the very phrase, get rid of worldly feelings, is suspect. To be human beings means to have feelings and emotions. Why would we even try to get rid of them? Well, of course, they can be troublesome and distressing, but getting rid of them is not really doesn't make any kind of sense. Even what he's calling worldly feelings, let's say, what does that mean? Romantic love, jealousy, envy. continues, those who are keenly aware of the precariousness of our situation as human beings and the brevity of our opportunity to awaken, and who use this awareness to hone their will, are not distracted from the work by worldly feelings. Feelings that arise because of circumstances can actually be used to fuel the urgency of work toward the fundamental. For people who have reached the state of awareness, even to fall in love can be a prod to work in Zen, to practice, because of the awareness that one will someday be separated from the beloved. Or with unpleasant feelings or emotions, grief, obviously, grief. I guess he would call that a worldly feeling. To experience grief, to lose someone, is a great spur to practice. And he says, preliminary methods of softening worldly feelings are taught for the sake of those with insufficient determination. Now, we sort of have to speculate as to what he means by methods, preliminary methods of softening worldly feelings. I think he would agree that if he were here today, that any kind of psychotherapy what could be understood as softening worldly feelings. That is, what he really means is softening the grip of obstructive worldly feelings, of neurotic problems. And he says this does not mean that work on the fundamental is to be undertaken only after worldly feelings are ended. That would be a long wait. There's so many methods of psychological healing methods and therapies. And even within Buddhism itself, we have these, I think of metta. Meditation. Here, this can be very effective when we are really snared in anger towards someone, and the anger is just obstructing our ability to concentrate. Well, we can use this. Metta means loving kindness, and there are methods of doing this where we radiate loving kindness toward the person, and it's more elaborate than that. Metta meditation. So there are practices even within Buddhism, traditional path practices, as well as contemporary Western practices, all of which can clear one's emotional life. Take out the knots, the emotional knots as a result of past experiences, and enable us to sit and concentrate more effectively. And we can do our best. We can go a long way in practice, even while we are still ridden with these neurotic and other complexes. In fact, they can be fuel for this work. And there are people who are drawn to practice because of the pain of these neurotic complexes. And sometimes practice itself can loosen these knots, open up the mind, and resolve even feelings. And if that is one's only motivation, if it's not to understand the fundamental, but if our what brings us to practice is to resolve these emotional issues, then one can actually, after their resolve, one can quit practice. I've seen it happen here at the center. People are on fire, go to Sesshin, and then they break through some of these painful traumas or other complexes, and then that's enough for them for the time being. And that's fine. You don't have to have the aspiration to awaken to your true nature to benefit from Zen practice and to contribute your efforts to others who are doing it. Even while you call to mind ways of softening worldly feelings when they arise, still you should not give up work on the fundamental. It is said that people with intense determination for enlightenment neglect even to eat and sleep. Such people do become tired and do become hungry, but they rest and eat in the midst of the work and therefore are not hindered even when sleeping or eating. Such people do become tired. Well, with respect to Sesshin, who does not become tired during Sesshin? Sometimes it seems that when beginners come to Sesshin, that they seem to feel that they shouldn't be tired, or that there's some, that tiredness is an obstacle to practice. But there is no such thing as going to Sesshin without being tired. It's just in the water. It's the context of Sesshin, the flavor of Sesshin is tiredness. And there are different kinds of tiredness that arise at different stages of Sesshin. At this this fairly early stage of Sesshin, we can just feel as though we're just flagging under the routine of sitting and sitting and sitting and getting up so early in the morning. We're not used to that. Who gets up at 4:10 in the morning ordinarily? And it's natural that we feel worn after one or two or three days of this. But it's all part of the process. It actually is can work for our practice. There's a saying in Zen, when you're tired, the ego's tired. When you're tired, the ego's tired. The mind of resistance, the mind of grasping, of craving, is tired. It loses some of its power, so that this true nature of ours can grow and open up and assume its proper place in the mind. If people who lack such determination go without eating or sleeping, they will become ill. This will hinder their practice, so they are encouraged to eat enough to overcome hunger and sleep enough to overcome fatigue. And this is the advice that we've given so often here in Sesshin, is if you're not ready to stay up all night, then it's probably a foolish thing to do. You want to get enough sleep so that you can practice pretty well. And who can ever evaluate what that is, but so that you're not falling asleep in the zendo. And that's part of practice, is learning to attend to what it is, how much sleep you really need, as compared to how much you want. We all would want 8 or 9 hours, but how much do we need? It's going to be less in Sesshin. We're using the mind in such a concentrated way. We're giving way to thoughts a lot less than we do outside Sesshin, and this conserves energy. That's why we find, as the days pass in Sesshin, that there is this force that on the ascendancy, this energy that builds later in Sesshin, because we're not squandering it with random, irrelevant thoughts all the time. An ancient Zen master gives this advice: when you walk, watch the walking. When you sit, watch the sitting. When you recline, watch the reclining. When you see and hear, watch the seeing and hearing. When you notice and cognize, watch the noticing and cognizing. Let's say think. Watch the noticing and thinking. When joyful, watch the joy. When angry, watch the anger. That's the end of the quote. Working in this way will lead to awakening. So he's saying, be aware. Be aware of what you're doing, what's going on with you. And that means not getting lost in thoughts. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.